It's always more fun to share with everyone. It's always more fun to share with everyone. If you have to give one to your friend.
Okay, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The virtue of cheering, it's a noble trait and something your child is likely to hear about during the first weeks of school, especially if he or she is in kindergarten. But there is one thing teachers beg their students to keep to themselves: their germs. Kids are notorious bacteria factories, often sneezing into their palm just in time to high-five a friend. And face it, not everybody washes their hands before lunch. Still, even with the usual caution, germs hang out in some surprising places at school. Joining us now to illuminate those places and help us help our children, help us avoid back-to-school sickness and back-to-work sickness, is Dr. Harley Rotbart. He teaches about infectious pediatric diseases at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. He joins us now by phone from Denver. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
I would expect the bathrooms to be a breeding ground for germs, but you've said that probably not the number one germiest place in school at all. It's actually water fountains.
Well, that's true. Bathrooms get cleaned more frequently than drinking fountains do because people assume that bathrooms are dirtier. And it is, of course, a good idea to wash your hands when you come out of the bathroom. That goes without saying. But it's also a good idea to let the water run a bit before taking a drink from the drinking fountain and to remember that kids' germs actually like moisture and they hang around in moist places. And so that means not just the bathroom, but the drinking fountain. It even means the cafeteria. Bacteria trays that get wiped down, sometimes wiped down with a moist cloth, but frequently not disinfected. And so even those cafeteria trays that are handled so often by kids can contain a lot of germs.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Dr. Harley Rotbart. He teaches about infectious pediatric diseases at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. We're talking about germs at school, why kids get sick, and why they drag it home to the rest of us. You use the phrase kids' germs. Are kids' germs different than the rest of ours?
No, they're the same germs. Okay. It's just that kids get them more often because by the time we're adults, we've seen enough of them, been exposed to enough of them, and been sick our sicknesses have been caused by enough of them that we are a little bit more immune. So kids are really petri dishes. Their immune systems are, in most cases, very healthy, but until they've actually confronted any single germ, they are susceptible to it. And so kids just get sick more often, up to 12 to 15 times a year. Kids will have colds, flus, stomach flus that can result, if we're not careful, in missed school. And then some of those come home to parents and result in missed days of work.
Now, it's really common to see in a classroom a box of Kleenex and the teacher sort of encouraging the kids to use it. But also you're seeing the disinfectant dispensers in a lot of classrooms these days.
Right. And surfaces do harbor germs, so that it is a good idea to certainly at the end of the school day to have the tabletops in the classrooms, the art desks, any other shared areas disinfected, because germs can live on surfaces for several hours. And again, especially if they're moist germs, like those that can be sneezed out or coughed out of a child. So disinfecting is a good idea, too. I always hesitate when talking about things like this because a lot of parents hear these kinds of cautionary notes and think, you know, we're putting our kids in a bubble. We are being too careful. We are being paranoid about germs. It's important, parents feel, to expose their kids to germs to keep their immune systems healthy. And all of that is true. That is, what I believe we need is prudence and not paranoia. We need to protect our kids from the germs that can make them sick because they're exposed to so many other germs and so many other ways to stimulate their immune system. There's no such thing as a child who's too clean. We're not being too clean with our kids. We're just trying to reduce the number of times and the number of days they have to miss school and we have to miss work. And so it's a balance, but it's prudence and not paranoia.
Does the germ issue have anything to do with the time of year that we start school, which is in the fall? If we started it in the summer, would there be fewer germs or not necessarily?
Probably not. The germs really follow the population, so that wherever we have kids in a closed area, in close contact with each other, we're going to have the sharing of germs. The reason we see fewer colds and flus in the summer, for the most part, is because kids are outdoors and their germs are being diluted. They're just not in as close contact with others as they are when they're in a classroom.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. Harley Rotbart, give us a call, 614-292-8513. The number again, 614-292-8513. We're talking about kids and germs with the return of school. If you have a question about that or a comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. So then there's the lunches themselves. You mentioned the trays, which I always remember as sort of soggy looking, and they always kind of bugged me, and I'm glad you cleared that one up for me. But you're saying that kids are at risk from the lunches themselves, and are you talking about the sack lunches or the stuff they serve in the schools or both?
Well, food poisoning from school lunches is pretty rare. So that really is, I mean, there are a few episodes a year where somewhere in the handling process, either because of a food handler or because of a shipping problem to school cafeterias, there is an outbreak a few times a year. But really, the issues with school lunches are that a lot of times parents pack the kids' lunches and there is no way to store perishable items until lunchtime. And foods are, when they warm up to temperatures that help germs grow, foods that are prone to spoiling can spoil even in the few hours between leaving home and going to school. And so there are ways to prevent that. Parents can, for example, freeze kids' juice containers, and those frozen juice containers in the lunch bags help to keep the rest of the lunch cool. Parents can refrigerate overnight the products that can be refrigerated, and if there is a refrigerator at school, kids should put their lunch bags in the refrigerator at school. Insulated lunch bags are a good idea, but there should be an ice pack inside. Mm-hmm. One of those blue ice packs seems to work the best. And the best thing is not to send perishable items to school. So lots of things don't go bad. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, for example, don't go bad in the few hours, but potato salad does. And so it's just a matter of kind of common sense. If you wouldn't leave an item out on your counter for 4 hours and then eat it, it probably shouldn't go in your child's lunch bag unless you've got one of those blue ice packs to keep things cold.
When it comes to staying healthy, we can kill the germs, we can wipe them away, we can also strengthen our immune systems. Can we help our kids do that too?
We can. Excuse me. And several years ago, I wrote a book called Germ Proof Your Kids, and the subtitle was Protecting Without Overprotecting Our Kids. And one of the ways to protect without overprotecting is really to remember things that our grandparents, our kids' grandparents taught us when we were kids. It turns out that a lot of grandparents' advice was correct about boosting our immunity. So, for example, weather and wardrobe. We were always told as kids, and then it was poo-pooed, that you should bundle up in the cold weather, and then people came along and said no colds are due to viruses and not to cold weather. Well, both are true. It turns out that we are exposed, and kids are exposed, to viruses all the time, especially in school, and if their immune systems are temporarily jolted by a cold exposure, they are more susceptible to the viruses that they're exposed to every day. There was a wonderful study done in England about this. 90 college kids dipped their feet in in ice water for a short period of time, and 90 control college kids in Cardiff, Wales did not. And within a week, there was three times the number of colds in the college kids who had their feet in cold water for that brief period of time. They were all exposed to viruses during that week just in their normal living, but because of that brief period of time that the immune system was jolted when their feet were in the bucket of ice water, those college kids were more susceptible. Exercise, daily exercise, 40 minutes a day of active exercise for kids will reduce their number of colds and flus by 30%. And so not only do we reduce obesity and not only do we get kids off the couch, but we keep them healthier because their immune systems are boosted significantly by daily exercise.
What is it about exercise that boosts their immune system?
Well, I can tell you the technical reasons. We can measure in white cell responsiveness. White cells are a critical feature of the immune system. We can measure in antibody response to challenges like influenza. And we see that in the test tube, the immune system is boosted. But this is simply an observation. And people adults who jog regularly, not extreme exercise, not marathoners who get sick more often, but regular daily exercises those adults will tell you that they get sick much less often than their colleagues at work do. And so adults can role model this. Adults will get fewer of their kids' viruses, but kids will get fewer viruses if they exercise regularly. And again, they're all exposed. Everyone's exposed. It's a question of whether you get sick or not following the exposure. Sleep is another way to boost the immune system. There have been really fascinating studies that show that sleep deprivation for adults, and there's no reason to think this does not occur in kids, sleep deprivation of adults will reduce the immunity to influenza, for example, to the flu, by as much as 50%. So that adults need 8 hours of sleep. Kids need more. Kids oftentimes need 8, 10, 12 hours of sleep. And if kids are not sleeping enough, especially when they're in high school and they're staying up late and they're studying for exams and they're waking up early for classes, those kids are much more prone with sleep deficiency to get sick during the year. So you put together a package of bundling up in the cold weather, of regular exercise, of normal amounts of sleep, and then you put kids on a healthy, nutritious diet with lots of vitamin C in their food, and you've got many fewer infections a year in your kids and many fewer infections a year bouncing around in your house and keeping you out of work.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As an old lab tech, is it still true that one part household chlorine bleach plus nine parts tap water is still a good household wipe-down solution for school districts in a budget crunch for wiping down surfaces, not only for bloodborne pathogens, but also for germs?
Yes, and in fact, if you go to the EPA website, you will see exactly what you said, and that is one part bleach, nine parts water is sufficient for even blood contamination, and one part bleach per 99 parts water is good for standard surface disinfectant when there's no blood contamination. But the best resource for that is EPA.gov, where they discuss disinfectants and approved ways of cleaning surfaces. But yes, household bleach is a very effective disinfectant.
Thanks a lot, Charlotte. Real quick, you mentioned sleep. Do you have any suggestions for getting kids back on a normal sleep schedule? The transition can be tough.
It can be tough, and the best way may be too late now for parents, and that is to start a week or two before school starts, so that the sudden exposure to school hours is a very tough adjustment. The best way to do this is a week or so, even 2 weeks before school starts, to start putting kids back on a school time bedtime.
And maybe at least at first don't let them stay up later on the weekends right off the
bat.
Well,
no, that's exactly right, that we really have to, the pattern has to be a consistent pattern because it's very hard to recover from a sleep-deprived or a sleep-altered weekend.
Are you a believer in vitamins, or do you think they should be getting it from their nutrition and their food?
Ideally, kids should be getting it from their nutrition, and really from an immune boosting point of view. Vitamin C has been proven to do two things, and doesn't do others. Vitamin C will not reduce the number of colds kids get a year, but vitamin C will reduce the duration of the cold and the severity of the cold. Most healthy diets contain sufficient vitamin C for kids. If there's some reason to believe the kids are not getting sufficient vitamin C in their diet, then a 200 milligram supplement for kids older than 5 years of age, a 200 milligram a day supplement is plenty. But most kids can get sufficient vitamin C in a normal healthy diet.
Okay, Dr. Harley Ropebart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anna. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Harley Ropebart teaches about infectious pediatric diseases at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Coming up, more on Wellness Wednesday. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is Wellness Wednesday. When we think of the dangers of military service, we often picture a battalion in the trenches under heavy artillery fire, but some of the deadliest threats are much less dramatic, make a lot less noise, and weigh less than a few grains of sand. Even as soldiers aren't in combat, they're often the targets of the tiny Anopheles mosquito, whose bite, when left untreated, can be as deadly as a bullet. Anopheles mosquitoes transmit malaria. And during World War II, the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps reported 600,000 cases of the disease. What's more, every year, according to the World Health Organization, about 200 million people are infected worldwide, and about 650,000 of them, mostly children, die. That's why news of a study that found a promising malaria vaccine has recently excited the scientific community. Joining us by phone to tell us more is one of the study's authors, Captain Judith Epstein. She's clinical director of malaria vaccine development at the Naval Medical Research Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And as you mentioned, Captain Epstein, you also are in the infectious pediatric disease business. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I had mentioned since your last speaker was also pediatric infectious diseases that we sort of had a connection.
Yeah, and you do. I mean, the malaria is very deadly to children. First of all, could we talk about what is malaria, how it's contracted, how the disease progresses?
Oh, yes. So malaria is it's caused by what's known as a parasite. And mosquitoes actually carry malaria. So the parasites actually live inside the mosquitoes. And what happens is when a mosquito goes to bite a person, we know that it actually takes a tiny drop of blood. But at the same time, it's injecting those parasites into the bloodstream. And what happens is if the person is not treated, they will develop malaria. The parasite will go to their liver, kind of sets up shop there, makes more copies of itself, and goes into the bloodstream. And then what can happen is if the person's not treated, another mosquito will come along and bite that person and pick up the parasite, and then they can transmit it to another person. So it's kind of a cycle.
So the vaccine's about saving people from malaria and saving others from the people who already have malaria.
Yeah, so the vaccine that we have been working on would be to prevent all of that. So what it would be is, you know, just like any other vaccine that a child would get when they're growing up, like their DPT or their varicella vaccine, it would be, shot, and we would like to completely prevent the malaria.
Well, there are malaria vaccines now, right?
No, they're actually, although malaria is a huge problem worldwide and a big problem for the military, there is no approved vaccine against malaria. And that's why we're so excited about these results, because they show us that we're now really in the right ballpark and that we think it's really possible to have a licensed vaccine for malaria.
I already mentioned that it's obviously a fatal disease in many people, especially children. Why especially children? Just because they're smaller?
Well, that's a great question. And what happens is that if you're a child and you're growing up in a country, in, say, in South Africa, if you make it past the age of five, you start to develop some immunity to malaria. And you keep getting malaria over and over, but you don't get as sick. But what happens with young children is that they have no what's called immunity. They are just the perfect target because the malaria can cause them to get very, very sick. So we have this what's called natural immunity that people in an area will start to get, they'll still keep getting malaria, but they won't get as sick.
Okay. And, of course, not to mention the fact that a child, particularly a young, very young child, isn't going to be slapping away the mosquitoes. They can't protect themselves.
Yes. And actually, the very sad part of it is that there's about one child dying every 30 seconds. So if you can imagine that, that means, you know, that while we're on the phone, there will have been two children dying every minute of malaria. So it's a tremendous, problem. And for the military, it really has been a terrible problem. And you mentioned about World War II, for our troops that are deployed abroad, this is a threat for them, and we want to try to prevent them from having to suffer malaria.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Captain Judith Epstein, she's Clinical Director of Malaria Vaccine Development at the Naval Medical Research Center. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We do not have email or Facebook communications today. Sorry about that. So how is it typically treated once you get it?
So if you have malaria, we actually, for almost all cases of malaria, you can be treated either with a pill by mouth if it's not very severe, or you can be treated with IV antibiotics. And, there is a cure, so people can be treated. But the problem is that in our military population, they're naive. So by the time they would be diagnosed with malaria, they might be very far along, and so that could be a big problem. For children, there's just not enough medication to go around.
And that has to do with economics.
Yes, with economics. So we know that in some of the heavy burden countries, about up to 50% of the inpatient hospital admissions and up to 60% of outpatient health clinical visits can be due to malaria. So it's just too enormous of a problem to be able to treat all of these kids over and over.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Captain Epstein, this was the first clinical trial that had a 100% success rate. I've been doing this long enough to know that's pretty amazing. Tell us about the study. How big was it?
Yes. We also are very happy with the results. There were 40 volunteers, and the study took place at NIH at Vaccine Research Center. We collaborated, so it was Naval Medical Research Center and the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, which is we call RARE. We collaborated with NIH and with the sponsor, that's Scenaria, and 40 people were tested, and we do what's called a dose escalation. We go up to make sure that the vaccine is safe. And it was found that when we got to the highest dose, where we gave five injections of the highest dose, all six of the six volunteers were protected. That means when they were tested, they didn't get malaria. And when they had four doses, six of the nine were protected. So we've never seen anything like this in a injectable vaccine. It's been shown in other kinds of models with mosquitoes, but we hadn't seen this, so we've been thrilled about it.
So what's in the vaccine? What does it do to the parasite?
Well, it's very interesting. What the vaccine is it's actually the parasites. And if you can think about these parasites, they look sort of like little squiggly, worms, very tiny parasites. And what happens is that they're irradiated. So it's sort of like stunning the parasite, sort of like, you know, knocking it over the head with a club. They're stunned. They're still alive, but when they would get into your body, they can't cause disease, but they will trick the body into thinking it has the disease. So in the vaccine, they're frozen down, so they're cryopreserved. And then when you give the vaccine, you thaw them out and you give these parasites. And as I mentioned, they get into your body and they sort of trick the body into thinking it has the disease, but they don't cause the disease.
That's interesting. What do they ever wake up?
Yeah, so I liken this sort of to, you know, when someone is saying, well, you know, please have my body frozen so that, you know, when I am near death, have my body frozen so, you know, 200 years from now, you know, I can be woken up and I can be given the cure, and then, you know, I'll maybe by then we'll be living forever. So you kind of think of that it's cryopreservation.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what happens with these parasites. They're actually frozen way down to about minus 150 degrees, and they are in this little vial. And then when you get ready to give them, you thaw them, put them actually over a little flame and thaw them out, and they basically wake up. And they've come out of their cryopreservation, and they would look just like any other little parasite under a microscope.
The vaccine was administered by IV intravenously. Is that typical for a vaccine? Then how did you expose the subjects to the malarial parasites?
Well, those are two great questions. So the vaccine was given by what we call direct inoculation. So basically, you would see the person's vein, and it's injected right into the vein very quickly. It's not like, you know, you think of an IV pole hanging or something like that.
Okay.
It's really just a quick inoculation. And that is really because we are trying to almost, it's like mimicking what mosquitoes do. We want to get them into the bloodstream so they can go where they need to go and protect the person. So that's how, and it's a novel way. We found it to be very safe, and people didn't have really adverse events from it. So it is a new way, but we think it's very promising. As far as testing them with malaria, this is something that it's also, I think it's very interesting. We actually can go back several weeks after they finish the immunization. We have them go inside an area where we take infected mosquitoes. So these are mosquitoes which really have malaria, and we take five of those. We put them in a cup. It looks like a little ice cream cup, and then we put that on the person's arm so that, you know, they're kind of sitting with the cup under their arm. The mosquitoes can't get out, and they get five bites from those mosquitoes. And it's real simple. If the vaccine works, they won't get malaria. If the vaccine doesn't work, they will get what we call, we'll see that they have malaria in their bloodstream, and we'll treat them right away.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking of those old Off commercials where the guy sticks his arm in the box filled
with
mosquitoes.
It's very, very similar. And people sometimes say, wow, why would someone do that? Because, you know they're going to get malaria. But we at the Navy and the Army, we have a long experience with this, been doing it actually since the 1970s. And we monitor the people very, very carefully. We actually stay with them overnight. We stay. There's always doctors and nurses. And as soon as we see that they have the tiniest bit of malaria in their bloodstream, then we treat them. But it is something that's been around for a long time.
You mean you've been doing this, meaning human trials?
Yes, it's actually. So the first trials with this kind of vaccine were back in the 1970s, and the Navy was one of the first two groups to do them.
Using cryogenics?
No, actually,
okay.
what it was, and this is, it's a little bit hard to kind of wrap your mind around it, but the mosquitoes actually carry these weakened parasites. So people knew that if they took mosquitoes and they basically irradiate the mosquito with the parasite in it and then let the mosquitoes bite people, you could completely protect people from malaria. And we've known that. Navy researchers have known that since the early 1970s. It's just that no one could figure out how to get those parasites, those little sporozoites, we call them, little parasites, into a vial so it could be given as a vaccine. And that's what our collaborators, actually a former Navy captain who was here at the Naval Medical Research Center, Steve Hoffman, he and his company Scenaria figured out how to do that. So that's why it's really going back to something in the past that we know worked.
Does malaria mutate in the sense that you would have to change up the vaccine from time to time?
Well, you're asking really great questions. I think they're really great scientific questions, and that actually is something that we think about, because malaria is sort of like a very, as a foe, it's very difficult because it can change like that. But one of the things about this vaccine is we have actually the whole parasite. That's why we think it has a good chance of working. And we're actually going to be doing the first trials here at the Navy, we hope in the beginning of next year, looking at how this vaccine protects against different strains of malaria. So we can look at that kind of a question.
Your human trials have all been on adults, right?
Yes, we only test healthy adults. They're older than 18 years of age, and we make sure that everyone is completely healthy. And the people who are in these trials are usually people who are really dedicated to the idea of developing a vaccine. Many of them want to do it because they may have known someone who had malaria, or they've seen the devastation that it causes.
If it's been on adults before it could be used for children, it would have to be tested on children?
Yes. We would have to. It has to be tested on children, and it would be tested on children. Once we have all the initial studies done, then what they do is they would test it on children who are in endemic areas, because these are the children who could benefit from it. And it's done very, very carefully. But, as I mentioned, we have little kids dying by the minute. So that's a population also that really needs a vaccine.
Does the military have to wait until it's approved by the FDA and goes through all of those processes, which I know are very lengthy, and we don't have to go into that particularly now, but does the military have to wait for that before you can start to protect the people in the military?
Yes. The Navy would, the military, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, et cetera, would need a licensed vaccine. So that means we go through the FDA. It's all done very rigorously. We have to do other trials. We have to show that it's safe, and enough people. And it all has to be done with the FDA.
I know you've been waiting a long time for this, so a few more years, in your field is not surprising, but like you said, there are every 30 seconds another child is dying. Is there any way to expedite the process?
Well, we think that we have a good, plan.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy has really been working hard on this, and I'm spearheading this program with the Navy and the DOD, and we feel that if we have the kinds of funding we need, and we seem to be getting support, I guess we're thinking in the 4 to 5 year range, but we know it could take longer. And simultaneously, there'll be trials going on around the world in areas that have malaria. So there's a lot of excitement right now, and we're, this is what we live for as scientists and doctors, to do that kind of work.
Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for all your work.
Oh, thank you. It's a great pleasure, and I thank you for having me on.
It's Captain Judith Epstein. She's Clinical Director of Malaria Vaccine Development at the Naval Medical Research Center. Coming up, we're going to continue our series on the healthcare reform law, and we're going to talk about what already has been rolled out and what impacts that's already had. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're continuing our series on unraveling the web of healthcare reform in the United States. You're supposed to sign up by October 1st, and we're trying to help you understand it better in the meantime. The date, October 20, 2013, is also the birthday of singer Julie Andrews, who turns 78, I understand. But it's like I said, when enrollment for the Affordable Care Act insurance exchanges begins. That has a fair number of Americans wondering what health care will look like next year when the law kicks in full bore or almost full bore. But the truth is Obamacare has been changing lives for years now. The Kaiser Family Foundation's website has an interactive list of the ACA's provisions, and about 65 of them have already taken effect. Wait, we will not be reviewing all 65, but as part of our ongoing series, Untangling the Healthcare Reform Web, today we're going to consider some of the law's highlights that already have gone into effect, consider their impacts, and look ahead to what else will noticeably change in terms of coverage and quality care, or quality of care. Joining us now to talk about that is Kathleen Geminer. She's Project Director for Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage, UCAN Ohio. Welcome back to the show, Kathy.
Nice to be here, Anne.
So in general, is it true to say that the people most affected already are high risk, either in terms of medical conditions or financial vulnerability or both?
Well, I would say that the people affected right now are both. I mean, we have one of the things that was created by the law early on is the opportunity for young adults to remain on their parents' policies until age 26. So that cuts across, you know, a very healthy population for the most part, and has been well received by people all over the country. Other provisions that went into effect back in 2010, the high risk pool. There's about 2,300 people in Ohio who have pre-existing conditions who were not able to get in coverage by other health insurance companies and now do have coverage because of the high risk pool, a direct effect of the Affordable Care Act. Another really biggie for people is that lifetime limits were eliminated in 2010. And so people don't have to worry about going over the limit of their policy, having to change jobs in because the policy no longer covers them. So quite a bit in 2010. And I guess the other real big one in 2010 were the preventive services. New plans starting September of 2010 had to start covering a range of preventive services such as mammograms, colonoscopies, et cetera.
Has anyone tried to measure whether or not we are a healthier nation because of these changes already, or has no one looked at that?
At this point, we've pretty much, HHS, Health and Human Services, has looked at the numbers, but they really, I think it's a little soon to be able to make those kinds of determinations as to how this has impacted the health of the nation.
So healthy people with employer coverage pretty much haven't been affected yet.
That's right. Yeah, that's well, actually, though, some folks in if the employer made some changes in their plan, depending on the extent of the changes, they may have pushed their plan into being what's called a new plan. And if that's been the case, then those folks have gotten those preventive services for free.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Kathleen Geminer, she is Project Director for Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage. We've had her on several times. She knows what's going on with Obamacare, with the health care reform law. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. I'm sorry, our email and our Facebook is down today, so just use the phone, 614-292-8513, if you have a question. So how does all of that change, or does any of it change, the you know, young adults being on their parents' policy, the people for, you know, the high-risk pools, those kind of things? How does any of that change in 2014 when the law is supposed to take effect?
Well, let's talk about the high-risk pool first. That was conceived and implemented as a temporary high-risk pool to get those folks to January 1, 2014, when they would be able to enroll in coverage through the exchange, or outside the exchange for that matter, because the plans in 2014 can no longer discriminate against people because they have a pre-existing condition.
So that starts in 2014.
So, right. So yep. That will change. That is probably the biggest change coming in 2014. Now, the subsidies also go into effect in 2014. So let's say the young adults on their parents' policy, that stays the same. They can still be on the policy till age 26. But now, when they have their 26th birthday, there's something out there for them that, you know, with a subsidy attached, if they're not yet working at a level where they've, you know, they've earned themselves out of the
range. Or they're working for someone who provides health care or
right.
whatever.
Exactly.
And if they sign up, the sign up starts, or the registration for the exchanges starts on October 1st.
Correct.
Right when you sign up, you don't automatically get the coverage.
Well, that's right. The coverage starts January 1st of 2014.
Right.
What we have here is an open enrollment period. And this is not unlike employer coverage where there are open enrollment periods. The particular open enrollment period here is extended during the first year. So it starts October 1. It goes all the way through to March 31 of 2014. It's a good 6 months that people can enroll. However, if they want to have coverage on January 1 of 2014, then they really need to enroll during that roughly 2.5 month period starting in October 1, because if they haven't enrolled by around mid-December, their coverage probably won't start January 1.
Once again, if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. In March, the federal government asked the states to stop taking new enrollees in their high-risk healthcare pools. Why
Correct.
Was that, and what about those people?
Okay, well, that happened because when Congress passed the law, the Affordable Care Act, they set a very specific amount of money to cover that high-risk pool, and it wasn't enough. I mean, everybody knew it wasn't enough from the very beginning. And so what happened was, the states did their best, and the federal government and the actuaries to figure out how many people they could serve. But what they discovered at about that time is that if they were going to continue to provide benefits to all of the present enrollees, and carry those benefits through December of 2013, they wouldn't be able to take on new enrollees. And that's why they cut off new enrollment at that point.
Okay, let's take a call now. Pamela in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
I had a question. It would be a relatively small penalty for opting out of taking health care insurance. I'm wondering what is going to happen to health insurance premiums for those 50 or 60% of the population that already has health care insurance through their employer. In other words, do we expect this to go up in Ohio? And if so, what is the sense of how much our premiums may actually increase in the state? And I know that's not across the board for all the states, but that was my question.
Yes, I don't think that those who work for large employers are going to see a huge change. Now, so the real question, I think, are the smaller employers. And in those cases, it's really going to depend on the composition of the employer's workforce. For employers that have had a relatively, let's say, a sicker population, and of course, most people who are working are relatively healthy, but sometimes you have employers who are carrying some folks on their policy, either themselves or their family have had some major catastrophic events, and they may be paying very high premiums. No longer will that be the case, and so they may see their premiums go down. Same way with workers that have had heavily female workforces. Now the gender discrimination will no longer be possible after January 1, 2014. They may see their premiums go down. But if an employer has had a younger male workforce, they may see that their premiums go up. So it's really going to depend on the composition of the workforce. It's also going to depend on how well the uptake is in the shop. The shop, SHOP, is the small business exchange for employers with 50 or fewer employees. And it helps to spread the risk across more employer groups, and therefore it should be a good deal for small employers. And I think to some extent it's going to depend on the take-up rate. If a lot come in, then the shop will be more robust, more healthy, and those premiums should be more affordable. Otherwise, they may not see the benefit of that.
For younger people who are not covered by their parents' health insurance, there's a lot of talk about that's always been a group that's resistant to getting health insurance, but they're going to have to now or suffer the penalty such as it is. Is the sort of health insurance the exchange is going to offer, are those programs going to be different for them than they would be, say, for somebody in their 50s?
Well, the health coverage, there will be basic plans in the exchange that are differentiated by what's called bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. Mm-hmm. And what that has to do with is how much of the cost sharing the particular purchaser is going to pay. But the basic benefits are the same. However, for young adults under 30, they can buy a catastrophic plan. And also for persons who can't
afford.
Meaning
if they get in an accident or something like that?
Right. They would have, you know, in those kinds of cases, they have very high deductibles, but they do have coverage. So for those young adults, that's what they're going to have. Let me just also mention something here, because I know this is a short segment. And people don't have to wait until October 1st to take some action. They can actually go on to healthcare.gov. It's just healthcare, all one word, .gov. And they can sign up to receive email notices so that they are being informed as we move along of all the different opportunities that will be there, and, you know, how to get a hold of navigators who can help them to enroll. So there are things people can do right now to get ready for October 1st.
Thanks, Pamela, for that question. Catherine in Columbus, you're on the air with Kathleen Geminer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What can we do for you?
I'm calling because I was recently laid off from my job, and I'm wondering if there are any special options for unemployed.
Well, there are some things. Now, depending on the size of the workforce in the job that you had, you may be eligible to extend your coverage through COBRA. There's also, in Ohio, for those with under 20 employees, something called Mini COBRA. And so these can be good options if you still have some income to continue to pay the premium, because instead of just your share, you would now have to pay the whole premium. And for a lot of people who are laid off, that's not an option. There are various ways that you can get assistance, also depending on your family composition. You may be eligible for Medicaid, so that's another option. If you have special medical needs, there are pharmaceutical programs that could be available to you, and also the federally qualified health centers are a very good source of health care. So these are all things that you can do now, but I would suggest that you begin thinking about getting ready for October 1st, because if you have no income, if you have no income, and this is a little twist, you will not be able to get a subsidy. And this is something people, I know, aren't going to be happy to hear.
These are the people who fall between the cracks.
Yes, and this is why it's so important that the state of Ohio expand the Medicaid program. Because Congress, when it passed the Affordable Care Act, expected everybody under 100% of the poverty level, which is around $11,000 or so for a single person, to get their coverage through Medicaid. And if you don't qualify for one of the categories, like, let's say, being a parent of a child in your home, being a pregnant woman, et cetera, then you would not be able to get Medicaid. If the state expands it, then, of course, you will. And that's why we have to, you know, we really have to hope that the legislature does that.
Okay, Catherine, I'm sorry. Good luck with that. Try to get a quick call in here. Tim in Springfield, you're on the air. We're running out of time, but I want to squeeze you in.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. with child support and Obamacare, my daughter was asking me, she's still 19 in high school, if I'm required by law to continue carrying her on my health insurance.
Well, that of course is a question of child support law, and I don't know what your child support, your decree requires. You certainly can carry her up to the age of 26 on your policy.
But even if it doesn't have anything to do with child care, a parent's not required to do it.
Well, no, after 19.
Yeah.
But there may be something in his own decree that said he has to carry them through college or something like that. I just
wanted to make sure that the law
under the
doesn't
Affordable
force
Care
parents,
Act.
Parents
right, under the Affordable Care Act, he's not required to.
Okay, Tim, I hope that helped.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care. That is all the time we have. We will have Kathleen Geminer back to talk more about this as things roll out, as we have over the last 3 years. And we'll continue to talk about this every week in one form or another. If you have any ideas, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We welcome your ideas for future shows as part of this series. Kathleen Geminer, thanks for joining us again.
Happy to be here, Ann.
Kathleen is the project director for Ohio Consumers for Healthcare Coverage. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.